It is also mistaken to think that former and later lives do not exist because they are not directly perceived. One cannot posit something as non-existent simply because one has not seen it. There are many internal and external phenomena newly seen or heard through modern technology that were not heard or seen by our ancestors. Moreover, knowledge of former and later lifetimes arises in those who have reached a high level of meditative stabilization due to the power of religious meditation. Furthermore, there are many persons who remember the circumstances of former lifetimes due to predisposing tendencies from the past. There is also the account of a Buddhist scholar in India who, after debating with a nihilist, wanted his opponent to have direct knowledge of former and later lifetimes, and thus, with the king and others as witnesses, died and was reborn as the master Chandragoman. In Tibet as well, there have been many persons who remembered their former lives, recognizing persons, possessions, and so forth, from the earlier lifetime, and relating events of the past. Therefore, since we certainly have future lives, we definitely must do something about them. The way to do so is this. Having cultivated a good mind, we must strive to eliminate all faults and cause all good qualities to arise. The method is either to cultivate a good path over successive lifetimes, or to achieve a path that has the capacity to sever the continuum of cyclic existence in this very lifetime, through relying on a profound technique, so that we do not have to die and be reborn in cyclic existence, samsara. Chapter 2, The Two Truths. In order to achieve liberation from the cycle of existence, one must know how to ascertain the basis, the two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth. Also, how to practice the path, method, and wisdom. And, in dependence on that, how to achieve the goal, the two Buddha bodies, form body and truth body. First, what is the presentation of the basis that is to be ascertained, that is, the two truths? The Meeting of Father and Son Sutra says, "The knower of the world, without listening to others, taught in terms of just these two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. There is no third truth." Similarly, Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise on the middle way, called Wisdom, also says, "Doctrines taught by Buddhas rely completely on the two truths." The basis of the division into the two truths is objects of knowledge. Objects of knowledge are twofold, conventional truths and ultimate truths. When something is established to be an ultimate truth, the possibility of its being a conventional truth is eliminated. And when something is established to be a conventional truth, the possibility of its being an ultimate truth is eliminated. Therefore, the two truths are mutually exclusive. Also, if either of the two truths did not exist, all objects of knowledge would not be encompassed. And because there is no such thing as a third truth, that is neither of these two, their enumeration eliminates a third category. If the two truths were totally different, in the sense of not being the same entity, there would be four faults. 1. The fault would be incurred whereby the absence of true existence of a form would not be the mode of existence of a form. 2. The fault would be incurred whereby even though one realized the absence of true existence of a form, this would not overcome the apprehension of signs of true existence of a form. 3. The fault would be incurred whereby it would be pointless for yogis to cultivate higher paths. And, 4. The fault would be incurred whereby even a Buddha would not have abandoned the fetters of the apprehensions of signs of true existence and all the stains of assuming bad states. If the two truths were the same, and that they could not be distinguished as separate even in terms of mere isolates, that is, conceptually isolatable factors, there would be four faults. 1. The fault would be incurred whereby just as actions and afflictions which are conventional ties having a mistaken nature are abandoned, so too ultimate reality also would be abandoned. 2. The fault would be incurred whereby the ultimate would have many different aspects, just as the conventional does. 3. The fault would be incurred whereby even common beings would directly realize the ultimate. And 4. The fault would be incurred whereby the afflictive emotions of desire and so forth would be produced upon observing ultimate reality. Therefore, the two truths are the same entity, but different isolates, that is, conceptually isolatable factors. Ultimate truths. An ultimate truth is the object explicitly found by reasoning consciousness that analyzes the ultimate. A conventional awareness is an awareness that is involved with objects of worldly terminology or conventions. An object explicitly found by that awareness is a conventional truth. In Sanskrit, ultimate truth is paramata satya. Parama means highest, supreme. Artha means object. Satya means truth, permanent. In this context, artha does not refer to welfare or purpose, as in the case of speaking of one's own welfare and the welfare of others. It means object, because it is the object known, the object analyzed, and the object found by the highest exalted wisdom. It is such an object, and because it is the supreme and ultimate of objects, it is the ultimate object. It is a truth because its mode of appearance and mode of being are not discordant, as is the case with false conventionalities. Rather, its mode of appearance and mode of being agree. Therefore, it is called a truth that is the ultimate object, an ultimate truth. When ultimate truths are divided, there are two: selflessness of persons and selflessness of phenomena. The Master Chandrakirti's supplement to Nagarjuna's Treatise on the Middle Way says, "In order to release transmigrators from the afflictive obstructions and the obstructions to omniscience, this selflessness was described as of two types, through a division into phenomena and persons. Therefore, the teacher spoke to disciples frequently of these two selflessnesses, extensively, in many ways. Having explained 16 emptinesses in the elaborate way, he again explained 4 in the brief way. These are also described in the Great Vehicle. When further divided, there are 4 emptinesses: the emptiness of functioning things, the emptiness of non-functioning things, the emptiness of the nature of phenomena, and the emptiness of an entity, that is, the object of the supramundane exalted wisdom that is other than the world. Also, there are the 16 emptinesses, such as the emptiness of the internal, the 18 emptinesses, the 20 emptinesses, and so forth. Conventional truths. Conventional truths refer to all the varieties of phenomena that are not emptinesses. When they are divided extensively, there are the 5 aggregates, the 12 sources, the 18 constituents, and so forth. Thus, Abandhu's Treasury of Knowledge says, "Heap, door of production, and type are the meaning of aggregate, source, and constituent." 5 aggregates. From among the 5 aggregates, the first, the form aggregate, consists of the 5 internal physical sense powers, such as the eye sense, the 5 external forms, which are forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and objects of touch, making 10, and non-revelatory forms, making 11. The second is the feeling aggregate, which consists of feelings of pleasure, pain, and neutrality. The third, the discrimination aggregate, is of 2 types, conceptual and non-conceptual, each of which also has three types: small, vast, and limitless. Regarding the fourth aggregate, compositional factors, the associated compositional factor aggregate consists of all mental factors with the exception of feeling and discrimination. The non-associated compositional factor aggregate consists of the 14 non-associated factors. The fifth aggregate, consciousness, refers to the six consciousnesses from the eye consciousness through the mental consciousness. 12 sources. Regarding the 12 sources, the six internal sources of consciousness are the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mental sense powers. The six external sources of consciousness, or fields of consciousness, are the form source, sound source, odor source, taste source, object of touch source, and phenomenon source. Eye sense power and eye source are synonyms, but form source and form are not synonymous. A form source is only the object apprehended by an eye consciousness, and thus must be colors and shapes, whereas form also includes sounds, odors, tastes, and objects of touch. Sound, sound source, and object of hearing by an ear consciousness are synonyms. The same is true for odors, tastes, and objects of touch. That is, odor, odor source, and object of apprehension by a nose consciousness are synonyms. The first five of the external and internal sources are physical. Because mind, citta, sentience, manas, and main consciousness, vijnana, are synonyms, all main minds, such as a main eye consciousness, are mind sources. Uncompounded phenomena such as space and emptiness are phenomena sources. The 18 constituents are the six constituents that are sense powers, the supports, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mental sense powers. The six consciousness constituents, the supported, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mental consciousnesses. The six constituents that are objects, the observed objects, forms, sounds, odors, tastes, objects of touch, and other phenomena. In summary, all compounded phenomena are included in the five aggregates, and all objects of knowledge are included in the 12 sources as well as in the 18 constituents. Therefore, all the phenomena of the two truths are included in the 12 sources and 18 constituents. When constituents are further divided, there are 62, and so forth. The purpose of delineating phenomena. In brief, since their entities, functions, divisions, whether or not they are objects to be abandoned, and so forth, must be known, one should become skilled in the six topics to be skilled in: the aggregates, sources, constituents, the 12 branches of dependent arising, the sources and non-sources of happiness and suffering, and the four truths, thereby coming to know what is to be adopted and discarded, and, through that, achieving the bliss of liberation, the state of permanent separation from all suffering. Because our minds and mental factors are under the influence of the afflictive emotions, or klesha, we incessantly experience this wheel of suffering in cyclic existence, and thus, when those afflictive emotions are abandoned, liberation is attained. Therefore, it is essential that the afflictive emotions, such as desire, be tamed. The supramundane victorious Buddha set forth 84,000 bundles of doctrine as means for taming them. Chapter 3. How the Buddha's pronouncements are included in the three scriptural collections. The 84,000 collections of doctrine are included in the 12 branches of scripture, which in turn are included in the three scriptural collections, which include sets of discourses, discipline, and manifest knowledge. The Superior Maitreya's Ornament for the Great Vehicle Sutras says, the scriptural collections are either three or two. Nine reasons are asserted for including them in three. There are nine reasons for positing three scriptural collections. Three reasons in terms of objects of abandonment, three reasons in terms of trainings, and three reasons in terms of objects to be known. Three scriptural collections and three objects of abandonment. The three objects of abandonment are the secondary afflictions of 1. Doubt, 2. Extreme behavior, and 3. Holding one's own view to be supreme. The antidote to secondary afflictions of doubt is the scriptural collection of the sets of discourses. The antidote to secondary afflictions of extreme behavior is the scriptural collection of discipline. And the antidote to the secondary affliction of holding one's own mistaken or low view to be supreme is the scriptural collection of manifest knowledge. In the scriptural collection of the sets of discourses, the aggregates, constituents, sources, dependent arising, the four truths, the grounds, the perfections, and so forth, are delineated well, primarily in the context of the training in meditative stabilization. Thus, the scriptural collection of the sets of discourses was set forth as an antidote to the secondary affliction of doubt, because it removes doubts, qualms in two directions, concerning the specific and general characteristics of those categories of objects of knowledge. In the scriptural collection of the discipline, engagement in all unseemly faults, such as attachment to internal desires for impure behavior and so forth, and external desires for good food, clothing, residence, furnishings and so forth, are prohibited, thereby avoiding the extreme of indulgent desires. Also, the use of even very good food, clothing, and residence has allowed for those who have pure ethics of renunciation, who need not acquire possessions and so forth through hardship and toil, and who, when making use of them, have antidotes to strong attachment. Thereby, the extreme of fatiguing and wearying asceticism is avoided. In this way, the scriptural collection of discipline was set forth as an antidote to the secondary afflictions of the two extremes of behavior, in that it teaches antidotes to the extremes of indulgent desire and of fatiguing asceticism. To summarize, if one makes use of good food, clothing, residence, and furnishings without producing afflictions such as attachment, pride, and arrogance, it is seemly behavior, and therefore it was permitted by the Buddha. Even though one has mediocre food and used clothing, if attachment to them increase, it is unseemly behavior, and therefore was not permitted by the Buddha. Thus, the important points in permission and prohibition are just the decrease and increase of internal afflictions such as desire. External factors are not of prime importance. In the scriptural collection of manifest knowledge, the specific characteristics of phenomena and their general characteristics such as impermanence, suffering, and selflessness are clearly and unerringly delineated. If one becomes immersed in these characteristics through hearing and thinking about them, the afflictions of mistaken views, whereby one conceives what is unclean, painful, impermanent, and selfless, to be pure, pleasant, permanent, and having a self, are extinguished of their own accord. So are ethics motivated by those misconceptions, and conceptions of bad modes of behavior to be good. For that reason, the scriptural collection of manifest knowledge was set forth as the antidote for conceiving one's own mistaken view to be supreme. Three scriptural collections and three trainings. The second set of three reasons for positing the scriptural collections as numbering three is as follows. The scriptural collection of the sets of discourses takes the three trainings as its subject matter. The scriptural collection of discipline is for the purpose of achieving the training in ethics and in meditative stabilization, and the scriptural collection of manifest knowledge is for the purpose of achieving the training in wisdom. the three scriptural collections are posited with those three reasons. Furthermore, regarding the manner in which the scriptural collection of the sets of discourses takes the three trainings as its subject matter, the lesser vehicle teaches the ethics of personal restraint with the vows of individual liberation, of completely pure spheres of activity and duties, and of viewing even the slightest unseemliness with concern. It teaches the meditative stabilizations of the concentrations and formless absorptions in the lesser vehicle mode. And it teaches the training in wisdom, the special insight that knows the four truths just as they are, from the viewpoint of the lesser vehicle. From the viewpoint of the great vehicle, it teaches the training in ethics, such as the restraint of ill deeds and so forth, the training in meditative stabilizations, such as the sky treasury and heroic travel, and it teaches the training in wisdom, the non-conceptual exalted wisdom that realizes the ultimate mode of being. Thus, the scriptural collection of the sets of discourses takes all three trainings of the higher and lower vehicles as its subject matter. Regarding the way in which the scriptural collection of discipline provides training in both ethics and meditative stabilization, it unerringly teaches the things to be adopted and discarded, engaged in and opposed, and thereby explicitly purifies ethics. When ethics are purified in that way, mental pangs and regret for misdeeds disappear. And when those are absent, one attains physical lightness or pliancy. Consequently, mental joy and bliss increase, through the power of which the mind comes to abide one-pointedly. Thereby, both ethics and meditative stabilization are established through the scriptural collection of discipline. Regarding the way in which the training in wisdom is established through the scriptural collection of knowledge, because that scriptural collection clearly delineates and differentiates the characteristics of phenomena, the wisdom that unerringly knows the characteristics of phenomena is produced by listening to the scriptural collection of knowledge. Through that, the training in higher wisdom is established and manifestly attained. Three scriptural collections and three objects to be known. The three final reasons for positing three scriptural collections are: the sets of discourses are for the purpose of expounding doctrines and their meanings. Discipline is posited from the viewpoint of establishing doctrines and their meanings in practice. And manifest knowledge is for the purpose of becoming skilled in discourse that relates doctrines and their meanings. The way in which the sets of discourses expound doctrines and meanings is that they extensively explain doctrines, letters, stems, and words, and the meanings that are expressed by them, the aggregates, constituents, sources, and so forth. Or, they explain doctrines such as the aggregates, constituents, and so forth, and the meanings, the four thoughts behind them, and the four intentions. Or they explain the doctrines of the ten virtuous paths that bring about attainment of high status within cyclic existence, and the meaning of the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, the paths that bring about the attainments of the qualities of definite goodness, liberation from cyclic existence, and omniscience. From that point of view, the sets of discourses train one in words and meanings. The way in which doctrines and meanings are established through the scriptural collection of the discipline is that the afflictions are subdued through teaching the application of pure ethics, as well as through teaching meditation on the impure, and so forth. Thereby, the doctrines and meanings propounded earlier are understood and realized through becoming manifest in the mental continuum. As a result, doctrines and meanings are established through the scriptural collection of the discipline. Through the scriptural collection of manifest knowledge, one becomes skilled in discourse relating doctrines and their meanings. All the pronouncements of the Buddha, the conqueror, that teach the essentials of method and wisdom in the practice of the three vehicles of hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas are included in the three scriptural collections by way of these nine reasons. Three trainings. When all topics of the three scriptural collections themselves are included in broad categories, they are included either directly or in an ancillary manner in the practice of the three trainings. The training in special ethics, the training in special meditative stabilization, and the training in special wisdom. The ethics set forth by the Buddha are special because they directly and indirectly benefit everyone, both oneself and others. Austerities and ethics taught in other systems of doctrine, such as using the five fires to bake oneself to death, or such as those of the non-Buddhist forders, are inferior, because they directly or indirectly bring misery to oneself and others. Similarly, the meditative stabilization set forth by the Buddha are special because by serving as antidotes to afflictions and misconceptions, they bring happiness not only in this lifetime, but also in other lifetimes, as well as the happiness of liberation. The meditative stabilizations of non-Buddhists are inferior because they are incapable of doing anything other than providing happiness in this lifetime by turning the mind away from external distraction. They do nothing better than cause birth as a god in the form and formless realms. They do not serve as antidotes to afflictions and misconceptions. The wisdom explained in the Buddha's pronouncements is special because it is able, either directly or indirectly, to clear away all obstructions of the conceptions of the two selves, self of persons and self of phenomena. The wisdom explained by non-Buddhists is inferior because it is incapable of severing the root of cyclic existence through seeing the mode of subsistence of phenomena. For these reasons, the ethics, meditative stabilization, and wisdom set forth by the Buddha are superior to others. Hence they are called the three special trainings. Chapter 4. Training in Special Ethics. The first of the three special trainings, that in special ethics, is the basis of all good qualities and the quintessence of the practices taught by the Buddha. Nagarjuna's friendly letter says, "The Buddha said that ethics is the foundation of all good qualities, just as the earth is the basis of the moving and unmoving." There are many enumerations of ethics based on abandoning the 10 non-virtues. If these are condensed, they can be included within three types: the ethics of individual liberation, bodhisattva ethics, and the ethics of secret mantra. Ethics of abandoning the 10 non-virtues. The master Vasubandhu's treasury of knowledge says, "Collected from those good and bad activities, the major ones are set forth as the 10 paths of action, either virtuous or non-virtuous. The ethics of abandoning the 10 non-virtues are rules for abandoning these 10. The three physical non-virtues of killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct, the four verbal non-virtues of lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and senseless speech, the three mental non-virtues of covetousness, harmful intent, and wrong view. Through the paths of the three doors of body, speech, and mind, the 10 paths of actions are performed and accumulated. First, the three physical non-virtues. Killing. Killing has five branches. The basis is a sentient being other than oneself. The thought is to identify that being without error. The execution of the action is to kill the being oneself, or to cause another to kill him or her using poison, weapons, knowledge, mantra, magic, and so forth. The affliction is, in general, desire, hatred, or obscuration, but specifically, hatred. The completion occurs when the person to be killed dies before one dies oneself. The path of the action of killing is completed through these five branches. If any of the branches is not present, the deed is a faulty deed and not a complete path of action. This also applies to the remaining non-virtues. When killing is further categorized, there is killing due to desire, such as attachment to meat, killing due to enmity, such as in revenge, and killing due to obscuration, such as in animal sacrifice. Within the category of killing, to kill such persons as a foe destroyer, one's teacher, a parent, a practitioner of virtue, or a renunciate is an extremely bad deed. Stealing. The basis is an article considered to be someone else's possession, or an article dedicated to the three jewels, and so forth. The thought is the motivation of wanting to take that possession by force, burglary, or deceit. The execution is to do this oneself, or cause another to do so. The affliction is generally the three poisons, but specifically desire. The completion is to remove that article from its place, or to think that one has acquired it even though one has not. The three types of stealing are robbery by force, as in the case of forcible robbery of the innocent, robbery by burglary, such as in breaking into a house, and robbery by deceit, such as in using inaccurate scales. Among the types of stealing, stealing the possessions of the three jewels is an extremely bad deed. Sexual misconduct. The basis is an unsuitable partner, such as the spouse of another, a close relative up to seven times removed, or a nun or monk who is keeping vows, or in an unsuitable location, such as with your spouse near an image of the three jewels. Or, the basis is a sexual act that is performed in an unsuitable orifice, that is, any orifice other than the vagina or at an unsuitable time, such as during the observance of precepts for one day, during pregnancy or a menstrual period, or during the day. The thought is the motivation of desire to copulate. The execution is to undertake that action. The affliction is the three poisons, but specifically desire. The completion is to take personal gratification by way of attachment to the experience of pleasurable feelings that arise from the contact of the two organs. There are three types of sexual misconduct, with someone who is under the protection of the family, such as one's parent or sibling, with someone who is protected by a spouse, or with someone who is protected by religion, such as a nun or monk. From among perverse desires, deviant behavior with someone who is both one's parent and a foe destroyer is an extremely bad deed. Next, the four verbal non-virtues. Lying. The basis is a person other than oneself. The thought is the motivation of wishing to say, for example, I saw such and such, when one did not see it, with the intention to mislead someone. The execution is the communication of that either physically or verbally. The affliction may be any of the three poisons. The completion is for another to understand the meaning. The execution of this is not necessarily achieved verbally. There are also cases of falsehood through physical gestures. There are three types of lying. The first is falsity leading to downfall, which is, for example, to pretend to have achieved superhuman qualities, that is, high qualities, when one has not. The other two types are great falsehood that brings help or harm to oneself or others, and a slight lie that does not help or harm. Within the various types of falsehood, deprecating a Buddha and deceiving one's guru, parents, and so forth are extremely bad deeds. Divisive speech. The basis is other people who are in a state of harmony. The thought is the desire to divide them. The execution is to undertake that action. The affliction is the three poisons, specifically hatred. The completion is the other party's understanding the meaning. Acting with the intention to cause further disagreement between enemies who are seeking reconciliation is also included in this. There are three types of divisive speech. Overt divisiveness, as in directly separating friends. Indirect divisiveness, such as causing division through implication. And covert divisiveness, such as causing dissension deceptively. Among the types of divisive speech, causing dissension between teacher and student, or within the spiritual community, is an extremely bad deed. Harsh speech. The basis is part of the continuum of the sentient being. The thought is the motivation of wanting to say something unpleasant. The execution is to strive to do so. The completion is its issuance in communication. The affliction is any of the three, but specifically hatred. There are three types of harsh speech. Harsh speech to the face, such as saying something bad directly to another. Covert harsh words, such as saying a bad word to another in jest. And indirect harsh speech, such as saying something bad to another's friends. Among the types of harsh speech, to speak harshly to one's parents or to a superior being is an extremely bad deed. Senseless speech. The basis is part of the continuum of another. The thought is the motivation of wanting to speak nonsensically out of a lack of conscientiousness. The execution is to initiate flattery, song, and so forth. The completion is issuance in verbal communication. The affliction is any of the three poisons, but specifically obscuration. There are three types of senseless speech. Wrong senseless speech, such as the mantra repetitions of non-Buddhist forders. Worldly senseless speech, such as telling foolish jokes. And true senseless speech, such as explaining the doctrine to those who are not suitable vessels. Among the various kinds of senseless speech, that which distracts those seeking the doctrine is a very bad deed. Finally, the three mental non-virtues. Covetousness. The basis is an internal or external possession of another. The thought is the motivation of hoping for and wishing for another's prosperity or articles. The execution is to think about it again and again. The affliction is any of the three poisons, but specifically desire. The completion is to engage in that action again and again without shame or embarrassment and without resorting to its antidote. There are three types of covetousness. Coveting things that are one's own, such as attachment to one's lineage. Coveting things owned by another, such as attachment to another's prosperity, and coveting that which is neither of those, such as wishing for treasure under the ground. Among the various types of covetousness, coveting the goods of a renunciate is a very bad deed. Harmful intent. The basis is part of the continuum of a sentient being. The thought is the motivation of wishing to harm, such as to kill or strike. The execution is an occasion of such an intention. The affliction is any of the three afflictions, but specifically hatred. The completion is to view this intent as a good quality and not want to apply its antidote. There are three types of harmful intent. Harmful intent arising from hatred, such as an intention to kill another in battle. Harmful intent arising from jealousy, such as an intention to harm a rival, and harmful intent arising from enmity, such as the wish to harm someone even though that person has withdrawn any offensiveness. Among the types of harmful intent, the harmful intent of motivating a deed of immediate retribution, killing one's father, killing one's mother, killing a foe destroyer, causing blood to flow from the body of a Buddha with evil intent, and causing dissension within the spiritual community, is an extremely bad deed. Wrong view. The basis is a virtuous or non-virtuous phenomenon. The thought is a motivation to view virtue and bad deeds as non-existent, to view cause and effect mistakenly, and so forth. The execution is an occasion of thinking such repeatedly. The affliction is any of the three, but specifically obscuration. The completion is to decide such and not apply an antidote. There are three types of wrong view. Wrong view with respect to the effects of actions, such as not accepting that virtues and bad deeds are the causes of happiness and suffering. Wrong view with respect to the truths, such as not accepting that true cessations are achieved even if one practices true paths. And wrong view with respect to the three jewels, such as deprecating them. Wrong views are the heaviest of mental non-virtues. The abandonment of these 10 non-virtues is called the ethics of abandoning the 10 non-virtues. Vows of individual liberation. The ethics of individual liberation are called individual liberation because they cause individual persons to be liberated from the suffering of cyclic existence. They consist of an intention, including the mind and mental factors in association with it, to abandon harming others, as well as the intention's motivational bases in accordance with ethical rules that are assumed with the motivation of wishing to leave all of cyclic existence with an attitude of seeking peace for oneself, not merely a wish for protection from fear or a wish for goodness within cyclic existence. When the ethics of individual liberation are categorized from the point of view of the base, that is, the person keeping the vows, there are 8 types of vows of individual liberation. Vasubandhu's Treasury of Knowledge says, individual liberation has 8 types. In terms of substantial entity, there are 4 types. The 8 are one day lay devotee, lay man, lay woman, novice monk, novice nun, probationary nun, monk, and nun. One day lay devotees keep 8 vows. Lay men and lay women keep up to 5 vows each. Novices have 36 transgressions. There are also faulty deeds and so forth that are partial concordances and are to be restrained. Probationary nuns must keep 12 vows, 6 root precepts, and 6 concordant precepts in addition to the novice vows. The vows of fully ordained monks are the 4 defeats, 13 remainders, 30 downfalls requiring abandonment, 90 mere infractions, 4 to be individually confessed, and 112 faults, making a total of 253 rules that must be kept. The vows of fully ordained nuns are the 8 defeats, 20 remainders, 33 downfalls requiring abandonment, 180 mere infractions, 12 to be individually confessed, and 112 faults, making a total of 364 rules that must be kept. Among the 8 types of vows of individual liberation, the vows of one-day lay devotees last for 1 day. If kept for 1 day, it is sufficient. The vows of the other 7, laymen, laywomen, and so forth, last as long as one lives, and so must be kept until death. Furthermore, a recipient of such vows should be free from the following obstacles. Obstacles to the generation of the vow, such as having committed one of the deeds of immediate retribution. Obstacles to maintaining the vow, such as not having legal permission or the permission of one's parents. Obstacles to enhancement of the vow, such as being so ineffective that one could not drive away a crow. And obstacles to beauty, such as golden hair or a maned ear. Apart from being devoid of these, there are no distinctions of high or low class and poverty or wealth. If one is able to practice in accordance with one's mental capacity, one is permitted to receive the vows. The rites by which someone who has not yet obtained vows receives them are of 2 types, the rites of the past that did not require great hardship, since during the Buddha's time, he took people into the spiritual community in a very simple way. And the present rites that must be achieved through great hardship, compared with the uncomplicated procedure of when the Buddha accepted people directly. Also, the way to keep vows already obtained is to keep them through relying on other people, to keep them through pure thought, to keep them through identifying the discordant class, to keep them through thorough training in the precepts, and to keep them through relying on conditions for abiding happily. The first, keeping the vows through relying on other people, is to maintain them through relying on the advice of a person who has heard much teaching, and through relying on the model of one with good holy practice. Specifically, having taken full ordination, one should rely on a fully qualified master with whom one resides. The second, keeping the vows through pure awareness or thought, is to maintain them through not being devoid of effort, which is enthusiasm for what is to be adopted and discarded, conscientiousness, which is care for what is to be engaged in and turned away from, mindfulness and introspection, which examine and analyze one's own mental continuum, and embarrassment in terms of others, and conscience in terms of oneself. The third, keeping the vows through identifying the discordant class, is to maintain them through identifying the causes of losing the vows, causes of degeneration of the vows, conditions for their maintenance, and the causes destroying mental clarity. In brief, studying, hearing, and thinking about the text on discipline. The fourth, keeping the vows through thorough training in the precepts, is to make an effort at the practice of the three basics, purification of bad deeds and renewal of the precepts, the summer retreat, and the end of the summer retreat. The fifth, keeping the vows through relying on conditions for abiding happily, means that one must abandon and guard against infractions based on clothing, food, vessels such as a begging bowl, and place of residence. The main causes for the arising of faults are called the four doors leading to infraction: non-knowledge, disrespect, non-conscientiousness, and having many afflictive emotions. One must make an effort to protect ethics, just as one protects one's eyes, through relying on the aforementioned five means for keeping the precepts as antidotes to these four doors. Bodhisattva and secret mantra vows. The vows of individual liberation are ethics common to the lesser and great vehicles, whereas the bodhisattva vows and the secret mantra vows are ethics of the great vehicle alone. Having received the bodhisattva vows, one must guard against 18 root infractions and 46 faulty deeds. Having received the secret mantra vows, one must guard against 14 root infractions, 8 gross infractions, and so forth, which are common to the five Buddha lineages. In addition, there are many enumerations of pledges for the individual lineages. Since for these two vows, the identifications of the individual divisions that must be kept, the ways of guarding them, and so forth, are very vast, I will not discuss them here. Chapter 5. Training in Special Meditative Stabilization. Among the three special trainings, the second is the training in meditative stabilization. The mind's abiding one-pointedly without distraction on any virtuous object is called meditative stabilization, samadhi. In dependence upon cultivating it, the actual four concentrations and four formless meditative absorptions are attained, and when its cultivation is complete, it finally becomes the perfection of concentration. When meditative stabilization is categorized, there are two types, mundane and supramundane. In order to achieve these, one must initially create calm abiding in one's mental continuum. Then one must create special insight, and at that point, one has created a meditative stabilization that is a union of calm abiding and special insight. The Bodhisattva Shantidevas, engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds, says, "Knowing that special insight endowed with calm abiding thoroughly destroys the afflictions, one must initially seek calm abiding. It is achieved by those who like non-attachment to the world." The reason why calm abiding must be cultivated first is that all qualities of the three vehicles are effects of stabilizing and analyzing meditation, which respectively are actual calm abiding and special insight, or similitudes of them. When calm abiding has been achieved, all analytical meditations, as well as all virtuous activities, have great power, because the mind is engaged in its own object of observation without being distracted by anything else. How to achieve calm abiding? In order to cultivate calm abiding, one must abandon the five faults and utilize the eight antidotes. Maitreya's Discrimination of the Middle and Extremes says, "It arises from the cause of utilizing the eight activities of antidotes that abandon five faults." The five faults are: 1. Laziness, which is a lack of enthusiasm for cultivating meditative stabilization. 2. Forgetfulness, which is the loss of mindfulness of the object of observation itself. 3. The mind's falling under the influence of laxity or excitement, although the object of observation is not forgotten. 4. Not making use of the antidotes to laxity and excitement, although one has identified that the mind has fallen under their influence. 5. Even though laxity and excitement are absent, one still does not concentrate on the object, but mistakenly continues to apply the antidotes to laxity and excitement. As Maitreya's Discrimination of the Middle and Extremes says, laziness, forgetting advice, laxity and excitement, non-application, and application, these are asserted as the five faults. One should meditate within the context of having abandoned these five faults. Regarding how to implement the eight antidotes that abandon these, the first of the five faults, laziness, has four antidotes, and the others each have one. The four antidotes to laziness are faith, aspiration, effort, and pliancy. The antidote to the second fault, forgetfulness, is mindfulness. The antidote to the third, laxity and excitement, is introspection. The antidote to the fourth, not applying the antidotes, is an intention of application. The antidote to the fifth, over-applying the antidotes, is the equanimity to leave the mind alone. One should meditate within the context of utilizing the eight antidotes. When one meditates within the context of knowing, first, the division of these preparatory levels of meditative stabilization into the nine mental abidings, second, how these are achieved through the six powers, and third, how these are included within the four mental engagements, one will easily achieve flawless meditative stabilization. The Superior Maitreya's Ornament for the Great Vehicle Sutras says, 1. Having directed the mind at the object of observation, 2. Do not allow its continuum to be distracted, 3. Having noticed distraction, quickly return the mind to that object, 4. The aware also withdraw the mind inside more and more, 5. Then, due to seeing the good qualities, tame the mind in meditative stabilization. 6. Through seeing the faults of distraction, pacify dislike for meditative stabilization. 7. Desire and so forth, as well as discomfort and so forth, likewise should be pacified immediately upon arising. 8. Those who make an effort at restraint make endeavor in the mind. 9. then natural arising is attained. Aside from familiarizing oneself with that, one desists from activity. The nine mental abidings are 1. Setting the mind, 2. Continuous setting, 3. Resetting, 4. Close setting, 5. Disciplining, 6. Pacifying, 7. Thorough pacifying, 8. Making one-pointed, 9. Setting in equipoise. The six powers are 1. The power of hearing, 2. The power of thinking, 3. The power of mindfulness, 4. The power of introspection, 5. The power of effort, 6. The power of familiarity. The four mental engagements are 1. Forcible engagement, 2. Interrupted engagement, 3. Uninterrupted engagement, 4. Effortless engagement. The first mental abiding, setting the mind, arises when the mind is initially withdrawn inside and placed on the object of observation, not letting it scatter to external objects. This is a result of the first power, the power of hearing, merely listening to instructions on how to set the mind on an object of observation. At that time, the mind for the most part cannot stay in place, and thoughts come one after another like a waterfall. One thereby comes to identify thoughts, and wonders whether conceptuality is increasing. However, this is a case of not having previously identified the array of thoughts. Since the mind was not directed inward, whereas now thoughts are identified due to having activated mindfulness, like paying attention to travelers on a busy road whom one ordinarily does not notice. Hence, there is no fault. Then, with gradual cultivation through the second power, thinking, one continually thinks about and nurtures the continuum of the mind's placement on the object. When one is able to put together a slight continuity of placement on the object, the second state of mind, continuous setting, arises. At that time, thought is sometimes pacified and sometimes suddenly arises. One has the sense that thought is resting. In these two states, laxity and excitement are very plentiful, and meditative stabilization is infrequent at best. One must strive to force the mind to aim at its object. Therefore, this is the time of the first of the four mental engagements, forcible engagement. Then gradually, through the third power, the power of mindfulness, when the mind is distracted from the object to something else, one recognizes it immediately and places it back on the object. At that point, the third mental abiding, resetting, arises. After that, through initially producing the power of mindfulness, one does not let the mind be distracted from the object of observation, and thus the mind is naturally withdrawn again and again from its extensive range such that it becomes more subtle. With this improved setting of the mind, the fourth mental abiding, close setting, arises. Then, by the power of introspection, the fourth power, one knows through introspection the faults of conceptuality and of mental scattering to situations of the secondary afflictions. Thus, one does not allow the mind to scatter to those two. Thinking about and taking joy in the good qualities of meditative stabilization, one attains the fifth mental abiding, disciplining. Next, knowing through introspection the disadvantages of distraction, one stops disliking meditative stabilization. At that point, the sixth mental abiding called pacifying arises.